Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and how could I go any farther without saying to our radio audience that our entire broadcast staff showed up tonight on Thanksgiving evening after having several feasts at various locations around the state, and they're all here in the studio tonight. So Mike, Emily, and Audrey, thank you very much. And Johnny Cash, we want to tell you that don't forget, when you do pass Dayton, Ohio, you can homestead. So if you decide you want to stay there 5 years, you can actually own a place. Dayton is actually doing that. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio show and the Jumble Justice Radio show. It's Blog Talk Radio Network. I don't own it yet. I don't think there's a chance I will. Alan Levy wouldn't let me do that. But anyway, it's a great place to be on Thanksgiving evening. And tonight we're going to talk about a subject that frightened me a little bit when Audrey said the show is riveting, because we're going to be talking tonight about the Mexican Mafia. And I think some of them carry guns, as I recall, but we're going to be having Tony Rafael tell us about that. And he's studied the Mexican Mafia, which most people don't know a lot about. They just think of it maybe as a prison gang, but it is on the streets and very influential in Los Angeles and other parts of the Southwest. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Again, welcome to our show and happy Thanksgiving. We have so much to be thankful for in the United States. Just start that old thing that they have hanging up in the Texas prisons, that sign that says count your blessings and then recount them because you probably missed some. You've probably heard me say that before on the radio show. What we try to do here is discuss news, events, and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We have a couple examples tonight. One of them would take a long time to explain. It's a motel and hotel scam stunt that people pull. But if I have time for that story, I'll do it. But it actually goes on. Our show is dedicated to police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice professionals throughout the United States and the world that serve us. What we try to do is look inside a criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals. If you haven't got your Blog Talk Radio show by now, I'm encouraging you to do that. Go to Blog Talk Radio. If you had a Blog Talk Radio network, you could have talked to your family all over the United States and recorded it as a show, as a Thanksgiving enterprise. Think about that. You could all get on the phone all over the country and talk, and you'd have it recorded. for you automatically and download it. So any person in the interest group, any organization can broadcast their own show live and streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And now is a good time to get signed up, and it costs you absolutely nothing. Those shows are archived, by the way, almost immediately after the show is over. So you can download those in MP3 format and use them any way that you want. I mentioned tonight what we're going to be talking about is the Mexican Mafia. Gangs are a real part of American life, and certainly police officers see them on the streets, and unfortunately victims of crime do the same thing. In fact, we got a new story tonight that's not Mexican Mafia, but it's one that will just shock you if you haven't heard about what's been going on in Minneapolis and exported from Minneapolis. What you do as a listener is tune in like you're doing. If you want to call in during the news segment of the show, the call-in number is 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. We could hold five callers at one time if they choose to do that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Audrey's going to do a repeat blonde joke tonight, not because she didn't have the initiative to go find a new one out of the millions that she's collected, but because she thinks it might relate to a news story or several stories we're going to talk about tonight, and she's right. Everybody else in the world has commented on it, but how could I not comment on the Transportation Security Agency's new or revised search procedures at the airport? Everyone else in the world has commented on it, so why can't I? Right? Audrey, go ahead. What's your joke for tonight?
Professor Haley, our blonde joke for tonight has to do with a blonde girl attending school. I think our listeners will enjoy it and not be taken back by it. Here it is. Day one. A blonde comes home from school and says to her mother, "We learned how to count up to 5 today. I got up to 10. Is it because I'm blonde, Mommy?" Mom replies, "Yes, dear." Day two. We learned how to do the alphabet today, Mommy. The others only got up to the letter G, and I got up to S. Is it because I'm blonde? Mom replies, "Yes, dear." Day three. We learned about breasts today, Mommy. All the other girls are flat-chested, and I'm a 36DD. Is it because I'm blonde, Mommy? Mom replies, "No, dear. It's because you're 25 years old."
All right, I like that one. And we were going to relate that to a story that been passing around the internet, and all the major news organizations and some minor ones have been commenting and doing audios and videos and all sorts of things about this particular incident at the one of the airports in the United States. But it's all directed toward making us feel secure. Before we get to that, let's do a green tip, and I think this one is most appropriate for Thanksgiving. I'm going to read it right out of Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And here's what it says. Walk yourself to an old age, and it has beneficial results for our planet. Every mile you walk, this is a repeat, every mile you walk is estimated to add 20 minutes to your life. Walking is also the greenest transportation method, as every single journey in your car, taxi, bus, or train contributes to air pollution. So walking is a great thing. You know people walk. I know people that walk, and boy, does it make them look good, and they're fit. I mean, you know, walking is really it. It is the simply the best exercise. And this comes from a runner. I mean, I've run more than I got common sense, but walking is better than all of them. So remember that. And as you had that great big turkey dinner, with all the dressing and all the sides and all the desserts, now would be a good time to open that door and go out and walk for about 30 minutes or 40 minutes, and you'd be adding every 20 minutes, every mile you walk, add 20 minutes to your life. I suppose you could take that to an extreme where it wouldn't work, right, if you just kept walking. Well, that's more complicated than I want to get into the time app. Well, thank you very much, Esma Floyd. She always says great things. Well, let's take a look at some of the news stories tonight. And this one, I think, was almost in the category of a Jumble Justice news flash. I heard this, I couldn't contain myself. I heard this 2 days ago on National Public Radio. Jan Suman is a German psychologist researcher. I believe he's a psychologist, and he's been researching for years, trying to figure out why. I mean, this would have implications in criminal justice, but why people who are blindfolded can't walk a straight line. They've actually taken researchers out to beaches. They've taken them on the Sahara Desert, and they blindfolded them and asked them to walk a straight line, and they'll walk 20 minutes, 30 minutes, a half hour, something like that, and they can't do it. And apparently, according to the researcher, you can listen to this, just Google it on Google, just walk a straight line research. It'll go right to NPR, and you can actually listen to the audio. But they have been researching this apparently since the late 1920s. Gee, this is 2010, and they're still trying to figure out why walking blindfolded, you're not able to walk the straight line. And then all of a sudden, it came to me in the middle of the night, 2 a.m. or 3 a.m., I figured out why somebody blindfolded cannot walk a straight line. And it's because they're blindfolded. If you take off the blindfold, they can, in fact, walk a straight line. I'm trying to figure out why we'd want to know that anyway, but, you know, psychologists study all kinds of interesting and maybe not so interesting things. But I don't know. Should I write in, Mike, to the Mr. Suman and Dr. Suman and tell him what the reason is? Who knows? I can't tell. all right. I thought this was something here. We're talking about the Transportation Security Agency this week, and I understand their purpose is noble. They're trying to protect us from terrorist attacks in the air and prior to getting on airplanes. You've been to airports, and you've seen lots and lots of DSA people there at the airport protecting us. But I didn't realize how large the TSA had become. In fact, I had a student go out and do some research at airports immediately after 9/11. He went to four different airports, and he was a federal agent, as a matter of fact. But he was a graduate student, and looking around to see what was going on, and, you know, this was just minimal kind of security, and then TSA got formed. And TSA now has, are you sitting down, Mike? It now has 67,000 employees. I had been saying 45,000. It's 67,000. Listen to this one. 3,500 or more of these TSA 67,000 employees now make over $100,000 a year. Can you believe it? And they're not done. They're hiring, and they want to expand this to both subways and trains. Janet Napolitano has actually said that, the Homeland Security Director. And Mr. Pistol, he's not backing off on these kind of things at all, but I think we're at the point here where a little bit of common sense, a little bit of decency, a little bit of mathematical logic should come into play, because I think it's more dangerous to drive to the airport than it is to fly on the plane in terms of your chances of getting injured or killed. It would be in an auto accident as opposed to on the plane. Now, I heard the former director of security in Israel talk about this, and he says this is just by not using some, at least let these searches rise to the level of suspicion. In other words, if you have suspicion on the proof continuum, most people don't even know what that is, but, you know, down on one end of the proof continuum, you have a hunch, and up the next thing would be suspicion, then reasonable suspicion, then probable cause, what the Fourth Amendment talks about. Then halfway up would be preponderance. That's what you need to win a civil case. And then it would be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There's some other things in there I won't comment on. And we never require absolute proof of criminal justice to do anything, not even to execute somebody. Clear and convincing is in there just above preponderance, right in the middle. But at least require suspicion as opposed to making every person go through this type of security check. It just doesn't make sense. Israel doesn't do it. Other countries don't do it. But you talk to a person, they have some data about you, all of us, and then they make a decision whether or not you ought to be searched. When you've seen the ones now, you've seen the three-year-old being searched on the Internet, I think. I think you've probably seen the seen an eight-year-old girl searched. You heard about the guy who was searched who had some type of ailment where he had a bag, whatever you call that, and his bag broke, and therefore this his own urine spilled all over him. You've probably heard about the other woman that got searched, and excuse me, it's a general audience show, but her breast fell out when they were doing their enhanced pat-down search, and all three or four of the TSA employees, you know, went wild. Whoa, yeah, made fun of him. She was so embarrassed she left, and then she came back, and one of the guys said, "Boy, I wish I would have been the person searching," you know, that type of thing. Unbelievable. Then Congressman Ron Paul, he has a very interesting approach on this thing, and I'm gonna raise up some of the comments that Congressman Paul has made about this. And I think Ron Paul is an anomaly in the U.S. Congress because he does understand, he's a medical doctor, but he does understand common sense. And he has some things to say about these searches that I think people should be paying attention to. And he thinks that they should be stopped. And, you know, these congressmen many times can avoid these things, but I'm trying to raise it up. But here we go. He appeared on one of the talk shows, and he expressed his outrage and disgust with the TSA and its unconstitutional naked body scanners and genital groping under the transparent pretense of protecting the American people from terrorists in distant caves. If we tolerate this, Paul said, there's something wrong with us. He added that the American people do not deserve to be humiliated and demeaned by the government if they refuse to stand up and resist this. Paul predicted Americans will eventually boycott the airlines to put an end to this intrusive type of searching and the unconscionable use of dangerous backscatter radiation naked body scanners. And Congressman Paul, by the way, is a medical doctor, so he knows he's a gynecologist, as a matter of fact. Maybe the Congress will get off their duffs, he said, and do something in January. Yeah, they're there now. They're doing something. Their little lame duck session is going on right now. Who knows what they're going to pass? But I won't play the video. But Ron Paul, if you haven't read his book, The Revolution, a Manifesto, it's not kind of what you mean. He's not talking about violent revolution. He's talking about people taking back control with their governments, and he's a believer in limited government. He is a congressman, of course, and I think he falls right in line with Bobby Jindal, who's governor of Louisiana, and Jindal thinks that they should only put the Congress on part-time, only let them meet, so often. You know, the Texas legislature does that. They're only allowed to meet 5 months every 2 years unless a special session is called. Now, if you can run one of the largest states and economies, fifth or sixth largest economy in the world is the state of Texas, and your legislatures can only meet once every 2 years, I think we could cut down on some of the meeting of the federal government. But they're down there passing new laws all the time. Speaking of Texas, well, let me hold that one, Mike. Let's put up this one. This is so disgusting. In Minneapolis, they're now talking about a girl identified as Jane Doe 2. She came under the control of the Somali gangs in Minneapolis. Minneapolis sort of opened the door to Somali refugees, both legal and illegal. But she came under the control in year 2006 at age 12. And the Somali Outlaws, that's the name of their gang, and the Somali Mafia gang set a firm rule. Their members could have sex with her for nothing, but others had to pay with money or drugs. So repeatedly over the next several years in apartments and showrooms and shopping centers and bathrooms in Minnesota and Tennessee, the girl performed sexual acts for gang members and paying customers in succession, according to a federal indictment that charged 29 Somalis and Somali Americans withdrawing young girls into prostitution over the last decade. Now, what is the proper penalty if these young men are convicted of this crime? I don't know about you, but I don't think there's anything too severe. Can you imagine doing that to a 12-year-old girl? I mean, just absolutely incredible. And in Minneapolis, it's a city with a great heart, and I'm sure they opened up their city to these Somali folks. But and of course, we're not talking about all of them, but these gang members are just absolutely ridiculous. And I think we need to get serious about that. I can't believe that. Let's talk about the safest city in the United States. If I gave you now until this time next year and let you guess what city came out the safest city in the United States in 2009, I tried on a couple of guys today at Thanksgiving dinner, and they were not able to come even close. But what city do you think was the safest city in the United States last year? And I'm going to save you the problem. These are cities that are $500,000 or 500,000 population. It is El Paso, Texas. El Paso had last year had 13 homicides. And Juarez across the river had more than, let me get the figure, 2,640. El Paso, are you listening? El Paso, Texas, had 13 homicides for the whole year. And across the river, see that Juarez, they had 2,640 murders. Can you believe that? So hats off to El Paso. I think that's an incredible type of thing. Crime rankings are not without controversy, of course, the FBI, but we're very good with homicides. I mean, if you're talking about theft or burglary or something like that, there could be errors, and I won't go through the 15 or 20 reasons why that could happen. But criminologists say that cite other factors, including studies that show cities with a high number of Hispanic immigrants tend to have low crime. Now, let me see. That sounds a little contradictory, because I believe Juarez would be filled with a high number of Hispanic. Oh, he's talking about immigrants, so that may be something there. So I guess he'd actually be saying that the more immigrants we bring in from that are Hispanic origin, the safer our cities would be. That may be hard to substantiate in research. But isn't that incredible that to be across the river from a city that killed almost 2,700 people, and your city only killed 13. And I think up until this year, right now, they have only had four. This year, there have been more than 2,700 in Juarez, and there's only been four in El Paso. Is that incredible or what? Well, hats off to the El Paso Police Department, the city administration, the chief. I think that's an incredible story. And, I mean, this could become Tourism City USA, right? It's a beautiful city anyway to go and take a look at in many ways. But that was a surprise to me. I mean, I've been in the field since dirt, and I would have never guessed El Paso was doing that well. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's go ahead and switch up. And go here, Tony Raphael. He's a writer from Los Angeles. Yes, we're going to extract his voice off of Book TV. And we won't be able to hear it all because he goes on more than an hour. But you'll be hearing talk about the Mexican Mafia. And it's an incredible story. And this is an organization that's caused a lot of terror, injured a lot of people, and cost us a lot of money in terms of trying to repress their crime and prosecute these offenders. So give me a second to make the switch, and we'll be listening to Tony Raphael talk about the Mexican Mafia. And his book is available on Amazon.com.
It's working. Hold on. Google said, wait, we are. I'll keep you posted. I see a real player, so we're getting close.
Next, Tony Raphael chronicles the Mexican Mafia, which grew out of Los Angeles prison. He suggests they're responsible for more than 100 murders in Southern California every year. His talk from the David Horowitz Freedom Center in Los Angeles is just over an hour.
When I, Tony, a couple of years ago, when he broached the topic of this book, the Mexican Mafia, frankly, I'd never heard of the Mexican Mafia. I had no idea that there was such a thing. You know, we all live in, for those in the room here that live in L.A., we're very familiar with gangs and street crime and the violence and the disruption that gangs cause to our everyday life. But we never thought of it in terms of a mafia. And when you bring up the term mafia, that raises all sorts of, you know, the Sopranos and the Godfather and all that kind of stuff. We think of something very different than a local, you know, street gang or, you know, something on the corner in a neighborhood. You know, mafia means there's a hierarchy. There's you know, command structures and there's power. And when you think of mafia, you know, street gangs may have power over a neighborhood, but mafias, you know, when you think of a mafia, you think of power and control. When you have to include government, the media, police. You wonder how far those tentacles go when you use the term mafia. And I know that this is something that the press doesn't talk about. I'm certainly not old, but the Mexican Mafia was formed before I was born, so it's been around for quite a number of years. And you wonder why have we not heard of this? Why is it, you know, it's maybe known in certain circles, but it's not known by the general public. And to be the first person that I know of, to go out and publicly publish a book about the Mexican Mafia, where you're naming names and talking about all the people that make up this this circle, takes a tremendous amount of courage. It's not an easy thing. I'm sure it wasn't an easy thing to write about. Again, even with the book out, we're getting some attention, and Tony's been on radio shows. I haven't seen the LA Times review the book, unless I missed that Sunday edition. I haven't seen this on the everyday news in Los Angeles. You know, where's the story? This is a major story, and this is a major threat to our everyday life, and nobody's talking about it. It's just everything is hush-hush. So there's a reason why no one's talking about it, and maybe it's because of the intimidation and the threat. When you come out and you write about something that hasn't been discussed, that's very powerful, then you've got to worry about your threats on your life, your family. So it'd be very easy just to say, I know about this and I've got all this information and research, but I really shouldn't write about this. Why am I going to stick my neck out and threaten, have threats upon myself and possibly my family? So, Tony, we're really very thankful for you for writing this book. And I think you mentioned that there could be 20 new books written from this book. And of course, Tony will be signing the book afterwards, but this could spawn a lot of stories and newspaper reports, investigative reports. It should be books. It should be documentary coming out of the research that was done in this book. We're waiting for that, and maybe that'll happen. But you have to start somewhere. So we're very thankful. So, Tony Raphael, thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thanks. As Michael mentioned, this is an organization. It's not a disorganized group of individuals. The Mexican Mafia was founded in 1957 in the California prison system, which started with 13 individuals. And for the first 20 or so years of its existence, whenever anyone mentioned the name, there was always quotes around it. The newspapers would characterize it as the so-called Mexican Mafia, or the Mexican Mafia in quotes, no one really believed that such an organization existed, even law enforcement who were sort of facing it. Fast forward from 1957 until 1992. In 1992, the Mexican Mafia initiated probably the most significant initiative of any organized criminal group in this country's history. On the afternoon of September 18, 1992, some 1,500 to 2,000 Hispanic street gang members began to assemble as if on an invisible queue at the football field at Elysian Park. If the people who live in L.A. know that Elysian Park also happens to be the home of the Los Angeles Police Department Academy. You'd have to wonder if it's insanity or some kind of hubris that would bring 15,000 known criminals out into the open in broad daylight to assemble and have essentially a gang summit within the very shadow of the Los Angeles Police Department Academy. And no pun intended, but law enforcement at that time in 1992, as recently as 1992, really didn't consider the Mexican Mafia as a significant threat. Some gang cops saw evidence of it on the street. They attributed a few crimes to it, but they never really saw it as an organization until that day in September 1992. They were literally caught flat-footed. Again, no pun intended. The fact that they could do this in broad daylight really started law enforcement scratching their heads about the power and influence of this group. Interestingly enough, that was not the only summit the Mexican Mafia launched in that period, in that September time frame, September 1992. There were several meetings that took place at the parking lot at the Los Angeles Coliseum, in parks in Orange County, in San Diego, in the San Fernando Valley, and San Gabriel Valley. And each one of these meetings was held by a ranking member of the Mexican Mafia. The major initiative that the major policy initiative that the Mexican Mafia launched was what I characterized as the vertical integration of, for the first time, of a prison gang and street gang. There were three items on the agenda at those meetings. The first item was that from now on, there would be no more drive-by shootings committed by street gangsters. This was largely misinterpreted by the media as a truth. In fact, it was not a truce. It was anything but a truce. It was basically a change in the rules of engagement. Prior to that time, innocent kids and innocent women and flat innocent individuals were being killed accidentally by drive-by shootings. Drive-by shootings naturally attracted law enforcement attention. Law enforcement attention hurt the business of selling drugs making money. So one of the issues that they discussed, that they issued orders that there would be no more drive-by shootings, didn't mean there would be no more shootings. It said from now on, if there's any business to be conducted that involves guns and firearms, you're going to be doing it up close and personal, reduce the chance of innocents getting killed. The second item on the agenda was that from that day on, all Hispanic street gangs were called themselves Sureños, or Southsiders. Spanish word for the Southerners, Sureño. And the Sureño basically was a gang. Sureños would be gangs who were swore their allegiance to the Mexican Mafia. They were told that from now on, anything we say, you have to do. And the third item on the agenda was taxation. From that day on, every street gang that was involved in the selling of drugs or making money had to pay a certain tax, anywhere between 10 and 30% of the total drug retail sales to the Mexican Mafia. When you scale that up throughout all of Southern California, and you realize that there may be somewhere between 100 and 120,000 gang members, let's say from the Bakersfield down to the Mexican border, that's a tremendous amount of money that the Mexican Mafia started making. The it's interesting that the reaction from the press and the media was at best muted. There was virtually no coverage on it. They talked about it, and a few editorials were written about it, but most of the editorials got it wrong. They misinterpreted this drive-by initiative as a truce. And like I said, it wasn't a truce. It was a change in the rules of engagement. The power projection from the prison to the street, again, is something that has never happened before. And there are various mechanisms by which the Mexican Mafia, there's only about 250 to 300 members in the California prison system, locked up in prison, and on the street. Yet, those 250 individuals control an army of neighborhood militias, which we call street gangs, Hispanic street gangs. And they are, in fact, soldiers. They refer to themselves as soldados, soldiers. And they're more than happy to do the bidding of the Mexican Mafia. Very often, you'll read press reports about another senseless shooting that happened somewhere in the city. They'll find some 17-year-old kids dead on the street for no apparent reason. A lot of the times, these homicides aren't solved. Sometimes they are solved. The term senseless really is easy shorthand for things that the press doesn't fully understand. Very often, these so-called senseless shootings are the result of the Mexican Mafia assassination. In the book, I describe a kid, 16 years old, who ran afoul of a Mexican Mafia brother in his neighborhood, a young kid by the name of Randy Morales. Randy was assassinated specifically because he ran afoul of a Mexican Mafia member unwittingly. I mean, he didn't even know what he was getting himself into. But the press, and that one again, gave it maybe, I don't know, 15 lines in the newspapers. And again, it was a senseless killing. So it wasn't until more than 11 years later that this homicide was actually solved and actually attributed to the Mexican Mafia. So when you read stories in the paper about some senseless killing that happened somewhere, you may never know. We may never know, and even law enforcement may never know exactly the motivations behind that homicide. In this particular case, it took 11 years for Randy Morales' murder to be attributed as an assassination ordered by a Mexican Mafia member. Interestingly, the person who ordered that assassination was in jail at the time, in prison. And it almost challenges believability, but the fact is that prison is not, does not mean the end of a criminal career, especially if you're a member of the Mexican Mafia or you're somehow an ally of the Mexican Mafia. They do control the prison system in California. They control virtually every member. Every inmate, there are somewhere between 117,000 inmates in the California prison system. The overwhelming majority of those are directly under the control of the Mexican Mafia. It is not an understatement to say that the MA controls the prison system. Correction officers tell me that, you know, they're basically there to feed, house, clothe, and medicate the inmates. But the actual running of the prison and what happens in the prison system, it's pretty much in the hands of the Mexican Mafia. For instance, if you're a Hispanic criminal, if you're a citizen, non-citizen, or even non-gang affiliated, if you commit a crime and you land in the at Los Angeles County Jail, you're given two sets of instructions. First set of instructions comes from the jail authorities themselves. This is, you know, how you're going to behave and how you're going to conduct yourself and so on and so on. And then you're also given a set of instructions by the Mexican Mafia shot caller who's running that tier, who's running that block, that cell block. And the MA calls them the X-Files. And these are the rules laid down by the MA to new prisoners being inducted into the LA County jail system. If you contradict one of the prison rules, you'll get written up, you'll get a 115 form with your name on against. If you go against the Mexican Mafia rule, the penalties are a lot harsher than in a piece of paper. You could be assaulted all the way up to kill, depending on the severity of your infraction. Prison authorities know about it. They're almost powerless to do anything about it because the power is so pervasive. There are various mechanisms that the Mexican Mafia uses to exert their powers on the streets. They've got a terrific information gathering and intelligence system, and a very effective and robust communication system. The prime mechanism is the fact that street gangsters, if you're a 16-year-old kid and you belong to Florencia 13 or Bowling Street or Avenues or Canoga Park, Alabama, you know full well that when you do taper and you commit a crime and you end up in the prison system or the jail system, you are now in their house. You are now in their backyard. So when you're on the street doing whatever crimes you do and somebody from the Mexican Mafia comes to you and tells you, you're going to do this, you're going to pay your taxes, or you're going to go and regulate that guy who's not paying his taxes. If you value your health and your life, you better do what they tell you when you're on the street. Because if you end up in jail, you end up in their house. You come under their direct control. Fear is that mechanism that they use to control the behavior of street gangsters. And it's not just a few street gangsters. As I said, there's close to about 100,000 of them on the street, give or take. The information gathering system is also fairly elaborate and comprehensive. They use something called a burnout phone. Many burnout phones. The burnout phone is a phone line that the Mexican Mafia associate establishes on the street. Legitimate phone line. They're called phone company. And phone company sets up a line. That number is then given to an associate or a member in the prison system. That number gets around the prison system fairly quickly. That number is used as a collect phone call because you can only make collect phone calls from prison. That number then becomes essentially a switchboard for information. You'll have somebody calling from Corcoran into that number. You'll leave a message. And when somebody calls from Calipatria State Prison, he picks up that message. Information goes out of the prison to the street and back into the prison. So if you have associates who are in different prisons all over the state, they communicate to these burnout phones. And I'll give you, for instance, how much traffic, how much information travel is conducted through these burnout phones. There was an FBI surveillance. They put a tap on one of these phones in Boyle Heights. It was run by a guy named Shaky Joe Hernandez. And Shaky Joe ran a burnout phone for 3 months until the phone was shut down because he couldn't pay the bill. And then they go on and pick up another phone. That's why they call them burnout, because the bill is never paid. In a three-month period, Shaky Joe Hernandez's phone recorded close to 10,000 collect phone calls from the prison to his house. And he was there 8-9 hours a day taking information and transfer and relating information from one prisoner to another prisoner. And he was also collecting information on the street and feeding that into the system as well. So if something happens in Boyle Heights tomorrow morning, something that the Mexican Mafia should be aware of or want to be aware of, that information gets into the prison system by tomorrow afternoon. And by tomorrow evening, an order will be sent out to take care of that particular piece of business. Somebody isn't paying their taxes, they hear about it in the prison system tomorrow, and they'll do something about it tomorrow night. And then someone on the street will be tasked to take care of that business. So we've got essentially a real-time information gathering and distribution system conducted by the Mexican Mafia, and to some degree other prison gangsters, but the Mexican Mafia is probably the best exploiter of these kind of systems of any prison gang. There is virtually no comparability between the Mexican Mafia and other prison gangs. There are other prison gangs, the Black Guerrilla Family, the Aryan Brotherhood, and the Nuestra Familia of Northern California. But the Mexican Mafia is the only prison gang that has been able to project its power from the prison out onto the street to have the street gang members, the militia, the street militias, do their bidding. Um, They also communicate by means of kites. These are the kites and green light lists and wheelers, as they call them. Wheelers is a Hispanic term for a message. Little tiny pieces of paper about that big are used to write messages on. They write them with a needle and shoe polish, shoe black. These little pieces of paper contain the names of people and entire gangs to be green-lighted or targeted for assassination. And these are produced in the prison with the blessing of Mexican Mafia shot callers and released almost like a daily paper. There's a morning edition, an afternoon edition, and an evening edition. So the changes and the alterations are made to these green light lists depending on the information you see from the street. If in the morning, you know, Shaky Joe or somebody on the street isn't paying their taxes, they may get information in the prison system by that afternoon. Oh, yeah, he took care of it. He paid his bill. And then the next green light list will have his name deleted from it. This information hits the streets fairly quickly through visits, through family visits, and unfortunately sometimes through lawyer visits. Defense attorneys who do favors for their clients often involve themselves in passing information from the prison onto the street. And then, of course, there are third-party letters, which fairly not used as often, because they can be intercepted if somebody in prison writes a letter to the outside. That letter is very often read. But then they get around that by fairly elaborate and sophisticated cryptology. The Aryan Brotherhood has taught the Mexican Mafia how to use a Francis Bacon encrypting system that challenges even modern computer systems in its complexity. Francis Bacon developed this cryptological system in the 1700s. What's the point of all this? What do they do? Why do they want to control the streets? Well, the reason is basically money. The Mexican Mafia sees itself as a business entity, a business organization who happens to use murder and intimidation as a tool of advancing their business. And they do this through taxation. Virtually every Hispanic street gang that involves itself in dealing drugs have to pay taxes to the Mexican Mafia. And that percentage could vary from as little as 10%, sometimes it's, you know, $5 a week or something for a low-level dealer, up to $1,000 a week for a volume dealer. And again, you ask, you know, how do they know who's dealing? How do they know who's selling dope? They've got a lot of street soldiers. They've got a lot of people on the streets who are constantly on the street, keeping an eye out for who's doing what. It's fairly common for some families to deal drugs out of their driveway or out of their kitchen window. And it's a fairly common avenue of dealing dope. There have been moms who have been arrested and prosecuted for selling dope out of their kitchen window while they're doing the dishes. Somebody knocks on the kitchen window and hands them $20, she hands them a balloon. When people on the street see this kind of activity, they realize somebody's selling dope, and then, of course, there'll be a knock on the door to say, whatever you're making, we want 30% of. If they comply, there's no problem. They'll actually even protect them from incursions from other drug dealers. If they don't comply, then the first action is to rob them, take all their dope, take guns, property, whatever else they have. Second time around, if they continue to deal drugs without paying their taxes, is a murder, is an assassination. It doesn't take a green light from a Mexican Mafia member to kill a dealer. If you want to make your bones, if you're 16 years old, and you want to impress the Carnals, the brothers, as they call themselves, you can take it upon yourself to assault or kill an errant drug dealer who's somebody who's not paying their taxes, because you help them do the business. In fact, sometimes entire gangs are greenlighted. There are some gangs in, to this day in Los Angeles who call themselves tax-free gangs, green, and they also call themselves greenlight gangs. The reason they call themselves greenlight gangs is there's always a green light on all of them. So if an entire gang refuses to pay their taxes, the entire gang is sanctioned for execution, and that means that any who allies themselves with the Mexican mafia, basically that gang becomes a free fire zone. They can take them, any of them out at any time and earn bones, make their bones for the organization. And very often, you know, again, these crimes sometimes characterized as senseless. They don't know why this person got killed. Well, very often there's a reason behind it, and the reason happens to be taxation. More recently, there's been a number of heinous crimes attributed to Hispanic street gangs, and this is something I've been talking about for about 8 years, I guess, and it has to do with, for want of a better word, ethnic cleansing. It's sort of a tragic development in the history of this criminal organization. In 1995, it was the first recorded incident that I have of an innocent black, non-gang-affiliated individual being killed purely because he was black. The motivation behind getting rid of black citizens from neighborhoods controlled by Hispanic street gangs with an alliance to the Mexican mafia originated with the idea of blacks moving into the neighborhood, bringing gangs with them, and creating problems with drug sales. They figured if a black family moves into a neighborhood, a black gang will soon follow behind, and that black gang will get itself involved in drug dealing. It's going to cause a problem. So the Mexican mafia issued essentially a preemptive strike against blacks in their neighborhoods. I first became aware of that sometime about 8 years ago. It happened with a fellow by the name of Kenny Wilson. Kenny Wilson was a 38-year-old male black who was visiting friends on Monte Vista Avenue in the northeast of it, in Highland Park. He visited, went out with friends that night. He came back. He got into his friend's car to park it. He parked funny in the street. As he was parking his car, five members of the Avenue gang driving around in a van. They'd been driving around all night. They were armed with a shotgun, a .357, a 9mm, and a .380 automatic. They were looking for people to assault. They couldn't find anybody. They couldn't find anybody to assault. They came upon Kenny Wilson parking his car. And Alfredo Bird Martinez turned to his other cohorts and said, "There's a nigger, you guys want to kill him." Apparently they did. They bailed out of the van. As Kenny Wilson was parking his car, they unloaded on him with everything they had, and they killed him instantly. That murder hung in limbo for about a year and a half. They had no idea who or why they did this, who would do this, and why they did it. Because the robbery was not involved. They didn't find any money on Kenny Wilson. It was one of those, quote, senseless murders. And it wasn't until a couple of months later that one of the guys in that van, looking at a sentence of 27 years to life for attempted murder of a police officer, decided to use that information that he had about the killing of Kenny Wilson to try and cut a deal for himself. And he spilled the beans. He named all the people that were in the van and what they did and why they did it, and the reason they did it was they didn't want blacks infesting Highland Park. And that's only one. That's one incident. There were two other blacks that were killed in Highland Park, numerous assaults. And when I try to tell this story, and I in the course of doing the research, that there was similar incidents in Pomona and Compton, Orange County, San Fernando Valley. There's roughly about 20 documented incidents that I have of mostly male blacks being killed by Hispanic street gang members for the benefit of essentially the Mexican mafia, so they maintain control of the drug trade. When I first approached various LA news media about these events, well documented in court cases, I was told that they didn't want to start a race war. This is something that they didn't want to get themselves involved in. None of them doubted the facts of the case, the facts of this information. It was all there in court records. They just chose to ignore them. And, I made numerous phone calls to the NAACP and Rainbow Push, and I said, there's this phenomenon that I came across, and you might be interested in it, and I'd really like to comment about it. I never got a call back in 8 years and dozens of phone calls that I made to these groups. Nobody seemed to be interested in the story, even groups that purport to care deeply about their membership. And it was only in July of 2006 when essentially the story could no longer be ignored, because at that point, U.S. Attorney Alex Bustamante and Bobby and Barbara Bernstein filed federal hate crime charges against those four members of the Avenue Gang who killed Kenny Wilson, Anthony Perdomo, and Christopher Bowser. All three are black males, all three non-gang affiliated, killed for the sin of being black in a Hispanic neighborhood for the benefit of the Mexican mafia. Last week, U.S. attorney unsealed another indictment against the Florencia 13 gang, named 43 defendants in that filing. They were accused of a number of crimes, drug dealing, RICO statutes, and killing male blacks in their neighborhood for doing nothing other than being black. And it's a wonder to me that the media still chooses for some reason to ignore this. This is something that cannot, for some reason, be talked about. It baffles me. And it's interesting that...
Well, you're left to your own intuitions about why the media does not report this kind of thing, but I think there probably is some fear involved. You're talking about these organized groups that will kill for no reason, and certainly another reason, if you're going to write things about them in the paper that they're not pleased with. But anyway, kind of an interesting business, isn't it? And more power to Mr. Raphael to come forward with a book like this. And at some point, I think we should try to get a hold of this gang activity in the United States, although they're not. There are people trying with gang units, and certainly Los Angeles has a very, probably one of the largest, if not the largest, in the United States. So anyway, check it out, and the book yourself, if you're interested in it. You can listen to the rest of it on booktv.org, or if you want to read that book, after hearing a little bit about it, you can certainly buy it on Amazon.com. Well, that's our show for tonight. Look at the billing and see what we're going to be doing next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn take us off now with her song, We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, some sunny day.